Hello, welcome to the Cancer Network Oncology On The Go program, Frontline Chronic Myeloid Leukemia in Chronic Phase, Optimizing Treatment Selection and Molecular Response. I'm really privileged to be joined today by a friend and colleague, Dr. Jorge Cortez. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hey, George, thank you. Yes, my name is Jorge Cortez. I just moved to the O'Neill Cancer Center at the University of Alabama in Birmingham, and very glad to be here with you.
And I'm Joshua Zeidner, professor of medicine at University of North Carolina at Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center in Chapel Hill. And I'm speaking to you today with my own personal views that may not reflect my institution. But we're going to be talking about frontline treatment approaches for chronic myeloid leukemia. We're going to explore how the treatment landscape has really changed for frontline treatment, certainly over the past few years, and examine strategies for optimizing molecular responses in newly diagnosed patients. So I think this is going to be a really scintillating discussion and conversation. So I'm going to, you know, just kick this off and just kind of maybe take a historical perspective and maybe get Dr. Cortez's opinion here. But, you know, CML, before I trained, CML was really a death sentence. You know, this we didn't have a lot of effective treatments for CML. There was a median time of about 2 to 3 years before patients would progress to blast crisis. And ultimately, this was a life-threatening cancer. In fact, in the 1980s, this was the number one indication for a bone marrow transplant. And now we rarely even think about, you know, performing bone marrow transplants for chronic myeloid leukemias. Since the advent of tyrosine kinase inhibitors and imatinib in 2001, this has really completely transformed this disease into a chronic illness, of course, certainly a cancer. But many of these patients have normal life expectancies. This is certainly a very different prognosis than historically, you know, several decades ago. So I want to kind of get your perspective, Dr. Cortez. You've been through a lot of the drug development stages in this cancer over the last few decades. I guess walk me through how your approach has really changed and evolved over the past, you know, several years.
Yeah, it's been a remarkable transformation because, as you said, you know, some years ago when we were discussing treatment with our patients, it was you could do interferon, you could do a transplant, and you know, neither one of them had great outcomes. You know, transplant back in those days was not as good and not as open as it is now. Even that, so from all point of views, it was very difficult, a very difficult conversation. And you were talking about life expectancy and the risks of immediate following years and so on. Now, you certainly talk about that because it is a cancer and you want to make sure that it is taken seriously. But even through the time of the tyrosine kinase inhibitors, our discussion has shifted because now more and more we talk about, even from the beginning, about treatment-free remission. When we started TKIs, we were not talking. I mean, we were just telling patients, hey, this is something you have to take for the rest of your life and you'll be okay, but you have to be on it. We are, I think, focusing more on quality of life nowadays because we know that patients are going to be, many of them, on the medication for the rest of their life. And we've learned about these, you know, chronic low grade for us in the grading that we use, but not low grade for the patients. And so it's changed what your focus is and what additional information you need to provide to your patients. And of course, I'm sure you experience the same. You know, patients have educated themselves a lot better and they come already armed with this knowledge that helps guide the discussion in these ways.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think just putting it in perspective and having an oral option for all patients, you know, at diagnosis, which wasn't always the case, you know, certainly, you know, prior to imatinib's development. And we have so many of these agents that we can sequence throughout a patient's kind of treatment course for their CML. So we have lots of different options for newly diagnosed CML. Of course, imatinib, first agent available, approved in 2001. Then we developed second generation tyrosine kinase inhibitors with dasatinib, nilotinib. Then came the third generation tyrosine kinase inhibitors, bosutinib, which also became approved for frontline. And now we have, the new STAMP inhibitor, the allosteric inhibitor of asciminib, that potentially looks to be more effective than any of the preceding tyrosine kinase inhibitors. So when you see a new CML patient in your clinic, I guess give me a sense of what you're thinking about, what sort of risk stratification you're doing, what maybe shared decision making you're going through with the patient to determine what the best frontline treatment is for that patient.
Yeah, I think that initial discussion is very important, very critical, I think. And I like to spend a lot of time in talking about the disease, and what causes the disease, and what are the risks, and what are the goals, and how do we monitor, and all of that. And some patients already know some of that, but I like to repeat it because I want the patient to understand what are we looking for. At some point, they're not going to have any symptoms. Sometimes they don't. They never had any symptoms, and all their symptoms are going to come from the treatment, from the drug, from side effects, and anxiety, and other things. So I want them to understand what are we aiming for, and how do we get there, and then talk about what are the pros and cons of each drug. What does one give me that the other one may give me more or less, and so on. I do think that it is very important that I do want to make the patients part of that decision, of that conversation. I don't want to tell them, you have CML, you're going to take drug X. I want to explain my rationale and the options and all of that, and see their preferences. I don't know, maybe even the schedule, the fasting is a limitation for them. Well, that's a beauty of having so many options, that you can use those things to your advantage. Now, I know that that's probably not the case everywhere, and you probably have seen these patients that come, and they've never heard about, they just were giving this drug, and that's all they know. And I think we need to do that much better. I don't know how, what your experience is, but I think that's something that we need to probably do better.
Yeah, and I think a few points that I wanted to kind of emphasize that you mentioned. I mean, number one, in contrast to many of the other cancers we treat, right, about 50 to 60% of these patients are going to present asymptomatically. They may not have any symptoms. They have an elevated white count that, prompts them to get, more of a workup. And so, you're talking about treating a patient who may not have, at that moment in time, symptoms of the disease. Now, certainly about half or so of patients do present with symptoms of, splenomegaly or, fevers, night sweats, and have the kind of gradual onset of symptoms that leads them to their disease. But that certainly, I think, plays into the discussion, as you said, of walking them through what this cancer is, what the effects are, and the aspects of treating. I think the second thing is, because of all the advances we've seen in CML, many patients come in very educated about CML. They actually come in with the notion that they're aware of treatment-free remissions. They're aware of the goal to eventually come off treatment, which is really, I think, the goal for most patients that we see, with few exceptions with CML. So the conversation can be kind of targeted towards, whatever the patient's kind of notion is at that time when they come to see you. It's not usually a generic discussion about CML, because they've usually done their, due diligence prior to being seen. And every patient's unique. And certainly, I still see patients where you have to talk about the entire pathophysiology because it's the first time they're hearing it. I think the other thing that in my practice that, I think has changed maybe in the last year or two is that, I used to really, individualize the frontline treatment for CML for my patients based on everything that you mentioned? Once daily, twice daily, what's your lifestyle? What are the comorbidities? Do you have diabetes? Do you have hypertension? And we don't want to use the agent that's going to exacerbate those, you know, comorbidities or medical illnesses that the patient may already have. And I had a very individualized approach in that setting. I think asciminib has really changed that sort of paradigm, at least for me, because the ASC for First study, which, you know, was a randomized study, frontline CML, comparing asciminib, the newest tyrosine kinase inhibitor, to imatinib or any of the other second generation tyrosine kinase inhibitors. And across the board, asciminib had less side effects, you know, less toxicity, higher rates of molecular response. And there's not like any real comorbidity profile that would dissuade me from using asciminib and would prompt me to use a different agent. Whereas dasatinib, nilotinib, imatinib, they all have kind of their flavor of, well, I wouldn't want to use dasatinib in pulmonary hypertension or COPD. Certainly wouldn't want to use nilotinib in metabolic syndrome, diabetes, you know, cardiovascular disease. And it doesn't appear that there's anything that I've seen that would dissuade me, let's say, from using asciminib in the frontline. So I just wanted to get your perspective on that and whether that is consistent kind of with what you see in clinic.
Absolutely. I fully agree with you. You know, I'm sometimes asked, you know, in what patients would you choose asciminib? And, you know, my answer is, well, let me tell you what patients I would not use asciminib. And, you know, we know that those patients that have those atypical transcripts, the B2A3 instead of the A2, which are very rare, you know, their asciminib doesn't work. Other than those very few exceptions, because of the safety profile that we've seen with asciminib, and, you know, it is a good drug for everybody. I don't think that matters such as treatment-free remission should be limited to only young patients, for example. You know, why would an older patient not aspire for that? And even if that's not realistic, the better toxicity profile and better quality of life that has been seen and better tolerability, that's already a benefit, no matter what the characteristics. So yeah, based on all of that, I kind of follow the same practice as you. I'm very glad we have all these options, because there's always going to be a patient here and there that for one reason or another, you need to use one of the other drugs, and good to have them. But yeah, asciminib has become a very strong go-to drug for me.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that what a lot of people are waiting on, which, you know, I think me included and want to get your perspective, is the long-term follow-up, right? Mm-hmm. Patients on asciminib. We have, you know, 20 plus year data of imatinib, of course. We now have a lot more long-term follow-up with frontline second generation tyrosine kinase inhibitors. So I think we certainly still need to see that long-term data. And perhaps, you know, treatment-free remission rates, how successful that is with asciminib. But, you know, personally, I'm very encouraged with the frontline data. And so I think that's where, you know, my practice has really, you know, shifted and changed based on the ASC for First data. But that doesn't mean that the long-term follow-up is not still critical here, because things can obviously change over time. And if we see that, you know, there may be different sequences that are optimal, that is where I think the field would shift to.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, for the long-term data, there's the safety, where I feel a little bit more comfortable, because after all, you know, the phase one started more than 10 years ago. So we have, of course, there were fewer patients and so on, but I think that we've seen a good number of long-term patients with that. Still, you never know, you know, we've been burned before with you know, ponatinib and then nilotinib. We didn't recognize those arterio-occlusive events for a long, long time.
Yeah.
But the efficacy, and particularly what you mentioned, the TFR, because these early results are very encouraging. I guess the question is, how far will they get us in terms of improving the TFR eligibility and success? I think it is going to be higher based on what we already have very early on, but how much higher? And then, you know, from there, where do we go after that? You know, because it's not going to be 100%. So, you know, once we get to where asciminib takes us, what do we do next to get to the TFR to the other patients who either don't get to be eligible or who still relapse after that? So that's going to be a very important question for the future.
Yeah, I agree. I think now, you know, shifting into maybe treatment milestones, because, you know, you brought that up. And I think that is for CML now, that is really all we think about when we're seeing patients on TKIs. It's what's their response and how good is this response and where can this get the patient to? You know, there are kind of two strategies I see when I'm managing a CML patient is what is their immediate response? Does it require any immediate dose adjustments, switching to another TKI? But more importantly, the long term, is this patient on track for a potential treatment-free remission? And that always, you know, at least in my clinic, comes up very commonly because both are kind of intertwined with each other. And so, you know, my question for you and, you know, maybe to start the discussion is, you know, how much do you pay attention to those molecular responses early on? Is there a specific number or goal where you will switch a patient from a frontline TKI to a second line to get a better, deeper response because you intend to eventually want a treatment-free remission? Or do you think that this is kind of more a marathon, not a sprint? And if the patient's tolerating treatment well and their PCR ranges 0.1, 0.2, 0.3%, but they're not feeling any effects of that, are you apt to just kind of say things are, you know, no need to rock the boat here, continue as is?
Yeah, you know, I tend to take a more patient approach to the PCR. I think that as guidelines, these response criteria that we've established, ELN, NCCN, you know, either one of these, they're good, but they're guidelines. It, just to give you an idea where it will be optimal to be. But I think we probably have been a little too obsessed with that to the point where any minor variation triggers a change. And I tend not to do that. To me, if it's going down, it's good. Let's see. Because the other thing that we need to keep in mind when we are having these kind of conversations is, all right, so let's assume that this response that I have at 3 or 6 or whatever months is not good. I'm going to change. Do I know that the change overcomes that? And, you know, the one recent study that was done on these patients that had more than 10% at 3 months changing to dasatinib versus staying on imatinib, it really changed very little the outcome. So even if we recognize these as not likely to provide the best outcome, we don't know that the change is going to affect that. To me, the best is to start strong, both in terms of making the best selection for the patient, educating the patient about adherence and all of that, helping them by managing adverse events and so on. But then stick with the plan for, you know, as long as it looks reasonable. So yeah, I tend to be a little bit more patient. I don't know how do you manage these? Are you also very are you flexible or are you very strict on what the ELN or the NCCN say? You know,
I agree with you. I think I don't want to say I'm conservative or aggressive because I think it's really dependent on the context and everything. I do like to stick to the guidelines, but I don't use them without context. And so, like, for example, you know, if I am taking care of a middle-aged patient with CML who's having a very good quality of life and has no side effects and is, you know, doing normal activities, not being bothered at all by their treatment, And maybe let's say 1, 2 years into treatment, their PCR is not optimal. They're not in an MMR, but they're close. They're at 0.2%. You want to get to at least, you know, a major molecular response, less than 0.1%, certainly by, you know, a year and a half, 2 years. But that, you know, I try to get there at a year, because that has been shown to be prognostic. But, you know, these things are obviously, you know, there's a line in the sand from a distinction standpoint, but is there a difference between 0.12% and 0.09%? Probably not, right? It's like the discussion we always have in AML. Is there a difference between 19% blasts and 21% blasts? Clearly not really biologically. So I don't take the absolute number and make a change just based on the guideline. If the patient is then, you know, tolerating treatment well, having a good quality of life, and I say, look, we want to get below 0.1%. You're close. We can make more aggressive changes that could potentially impact how you tolerate some of these. And I'm not sure it's going to be beneficial in the long term. I may have that conversation with them as an option, but I certainly don't require the patient to change at that point or force them certainly to change. And I think a lot of patients may decide, you know what? Is that number really critical to get such a decimal point less when I'm feeling well? Now, if they're resistant or their PCR is continuing to increase or they're clearly meeting failure signs, that's a very different story. I'm talking about patients who are stable and close to, but maybe not at the absolute like optimal threshold. I agree with you that those are patients where I take an individualized approach. For sure, if patients are relapsing or having a molecular sort of failure, those are patients where you have to stop before things get worse, of course, and switch therapies. I do think about the long-term, you know, treatment-free remissions for my patients. And like, I know that I'm not going to get there unless we have at least a deep molecular response, less than 0.01% for some period of time. So I try to get there, but at what cost, right? And so that's a little bit individualized, I think, based on the scenario.
Yeah, no, I fully agree. I think what you mentioned, you know, at the beginning, context is critical. You know, you cannot take this as just a black and white kind of approach and put it in the context of who the patient is, what are the goals, and all that is critical. So, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think maybe just, you know, I think treatment-free remissions and stopping treatment in CML is probably, you know, the most impactful sort of discussion right now in the CML treatment landscape, because it's really our goal for most of our patients. And I guess, you know, for you, in your clinical practice, I have two questions. You know, A, do you think about that before you start treatment? Do you talk to patients about that sort of paradigm? And B, you know, how are you implementing that? Are you following, you know, the guidelines as far as, you know, how long to remain on therapy before thinking about switching? Do you not have the conversation with patients until they're at the time to switch, sort of thing? You know, I guess just kind of walk me through how your practice has changed over the years with more and more data of treatment remissions.
Oh, I definitely have the conversation from the first meeting that I have with a patient, especially, you know, for newly diagnosed patients, because I think that there's different benefits of that. Number one is just for the patient's sake to realize that that's a possibility. Now, I'm realistic. I tell them, you know, not everybody gets there and so on, but at least have them realize that that is a possibility. Number two, because that may affect the treatment, not may, it really does affect the treatment option that I do. And I go through that exercise with the patient on why this and not that and so on. And third, also because I think it helps with adherence. You know, when the patient sees not just the short term of whether I'm having some side effect or so on, but the long term goal of you know, I am putting an effort on these. Now I need to help them with the adverse events and so on, but at least if they realize the importance of adherence in getting to these deep molecular responses and therefore become eligible, I think it also helps them see why it is so critical, and at the very least tell me when they're skipping a drug, they're why they're doing it, you know, and things like that. And once they get to there, I do follow the guidelines in general, but I do strongly believe that certainly, well, first, I don't do it with MR4. I do it with MR4.5 only. And although I tell my patients the minimum that's required is that you sustain it for 2 years before discontinuation, I suggest that we continue for at least 5 years before discontinuation because there's data that decreases the chances of a relapse. So, but some patients want to try it as soon as they become eligible, and that's okay. I just want to give them that option because for some it's probably more appealing if they have a lower risk of relapse. And that may be, an option. I'm curious, do you follow the MR4? The MR4, because deep molecular response has become a vague name now. So I don't
Yeah.
know. What do you use?
I actually am very similar to you. I am reluctant to switch when it's just an MR4.0. I mean, I use that as like my absolute bar. I try to get to an MR4.5 and or better before stopping. And I also, like you, like to get through as long of a initial therapy. I like to get to 5 years. I tell patients my goal is to get to 5 years. Usually, if I'm stopping before 5 years, it's for a specific reason, such as the patient's like, share decision making. And they're like, look, I can't do this anymore. I want to, certainly if pregnancy or other like big lifestyle changes gets in the mix, that's different. But I like to get 5 years of treatment and at least 2 years of at minimum an MR4.0. But my goal is really an MR4.5. And I think it's kind of like everything else we're saying. It's the art. There's a lot of context here. It's really hard in CML to read a guideline and to follow that without context because it's like, well, if the MR4.0 definition is 0.01%, are you not going to change or follow the guideline because it's 0.011% or whatever? You have to always use your context in the management of patients. So I try to use that as a guide. I think I do follow mostly the NCCN guidelines and others as far as what the stopping rules sort of are, but I do base that on an individualized decision. I think we're probably pretty similar.
I think so, yeah.
And I guess just lastly, as we talk about, we talked a lot about frontline treatment and kind of, thinking about all these aspects, when you do have to switch to, let's say, a second line therapy in a patient who either didn't respond or, had a recurrence on their frontline, what are some other aspects that you're thinking about besides just the side effect profile? Do you have like your go-to second line, or is it kind of the same thing with frontline that you're kind of looking at all the unique profile comorbidities and kind of choosing on an individualized basis?
Well, it gets complex there because it's then affected by, we talked about the decision process and at that front line, but now you also have the variable, what did you use front line? So you could have done imatinib, you could have done a second generation, you could have done asciminib, and then the reason for change could be intolerance or resistance. So that variability, greatly changes what you do. I think that there are drugs, and again, if you didn't use asciminib front line, certainly it becomes a very valuable option second line. Definitely, if the first line was a second generation TKI, and there is resistance, in there, I have no question. That's my choice always. But if you did imatinib, certainly, you could do a second generation TKI. I still think that the results are better with asciminib, although we have much less data because we only have one study that has addressed the second line. It's a relatively small study, even less follow-up, and so on. I don't see a reason why it won't continue showing the benefit long term, but we do like to see data, so obviously that is important. So a lot of these factors play a role on the decision on how wide or narrow is my portfolio of options that I have for a patient. Do you have a different approach, or how do you manage it?
I mean, very similar approach. Of course, resistance mutations are always going to come in the mix, right? We're going to be checking a resistance mutation profile, and that will likely guide, certainly if that's positive, that will guide what we use. But I think where things are changing, at least in my practice, is using more and more asciminib frontline. We now have less and less information and data about second, third line treatment post asciminib, right? Because it's so new. And prior to that, it would be more of, well, if you're starting a second generation TKI frontline, then you're going to switch to probably another second generation TKI in second line. I usually don't go backwards, for instance, and use imatinib if a patient had already failed, a second generation or greater. I think there's a little more uncertainty now, second and third line after asciminib, because we just don't have a lot of data about how patients do on specific TKIs post asciminib, independent of the mutation profile. But I think exactly as you said, I think that's another area where as the field evolves and we're using different therapies up front, this is going to be useful and valuable information. There's obviously lots of other investigational, really promising TKIs, both allosteric inhibitors and not, that will probably also change the landscape for the relapse CML patients. So very, very interesting, interesting field that I think is continuing to advance, right?
Absolutely. It seemed to be stalled for a while, and now it's becoming, even more complex and variable. So very exciting. And it's good to see, because there's new drugs still coming and more data on these additional mutations in other genes, and all these things that are making these more complicated, but also, very interesting from the clinical trial point of view and the biology point of view. And obviously we cannot stop doing the research that is needed so that we can serve the patients and get them. Hopefully, you want to get a large majority into a treatment-free remission.
Right. And again, putting this all in context, the incredible advances that we've seen in this specific cancer, CML, in the past few decades is really incredible and has been really leading the foundation for all these other targeted approaches and other cancers. And I think we're only getting more advanced and better therapies and safer and better tolerated therapies for our patients. So all of this is really making a big impact in our patient population that we see every day. So I think I'll close that. This was, thanks for being here, Dr. Cortez. This is a really, I think, a fruitful conversation discussion. Always happy to talk with you about CML. And I want to thank you for the insightful discussion. I think the key takeaway for our listeners is that CML has really become a highly manageable cancer with multiple effective treatment options, and the treatment landscape is continuing to advance both in the frontline and second and third line setting. And we're now individualizing our frontline treatment and achieving the best possible responses in order to optimize long-term outcomes for our patients, with the ultimate goal being really treatment-free remission for the vast majority of patients. If you want more resources on CML management, you can also visit cancernetwork.com. But I'm really delighted to be here and talk with you all, and hope to see you again soon.
Thank you.